Greenberg, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush has signed a bill providing extension of unemployment benefits for people whose benefits are expiring. The Senate passed the bill yesterday. The Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History has reopened. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell read President Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address this morning to a crowd on the museum steps in Washington. The museum underwent a two-year, $85 million renovation. Nebraska's legislature is expected to approve an age limit today for its safe haven law. The law, intended to cover infants, has resulted in legal abandonment of teenage children instead. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Chevy, developing the Chevy Volt, a car that will go up to 40 miles on a fully charged battery before using any gas.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to welcome back to the program David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois. Once a month, he is here. It's always on a Friday. We've been doing this show for a long time with him to talk about personal finance issues and money management. And he begins by making a few comments. I'm sure he'll have some things to say about where we are right at the moment. And then if people have specific questions about their own financial situation and they'd like to have a little bit of advice, well, you can call in and ask a question. And I know Dave will do his best to help you out, and you can take that and hopefully put that together with other pieces of advice before you decide what you're going to do. So with that, we say welcome back. Glad to have you here. Now, you're going to make us all feel better, right?
Oh, absolutely. And good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, in spite of the dismal economic news and outlook, let's face it, everybody's been looking at it. Everybody's been reading about it. I want to focus this morning on potential investment strategies and lessons, which I believe are eminently sensible, so long as we continue to adopt a long-term view of investing. Let's begin by reviewing the last really gut-wrenching bear market, where all kinds of stocks, similar to today, lost 40, 50% or more of their value. And we really need to go back to the early 80s, about the 1982 period of time. And interestingly enough, when that dust finally settled, when people finally sort of caught a breath, it wasn't very long before stocks actually surged almost 60% the following year, and approximately 40% of that actual surge occurred in the first 6 months following those stock market bottoms. Now, there are several lessons we can learn from that experience because it's not a whole lot different from other bear markets, although this one is just terribly, terribly difficult. First, as we all know, no one can predict stock market bottoms. How many times have we listened on the television the last 2, 3, 4, 6 weeks to stock market pundits saying, well, we think we have reached the bottom? No one can predict stock market bottoms. No one has that crystal ball. Second, the stock market recovers well in advance of a general economic recovery by our country at large. That's very, very important to understand. The stock market is a predictor of what is going to occur in the future, well in advance of our own U.S. economic recovery. Third, timing the stock market is literally impossible. So it's important to maintain stock market exposure even in the worst of times. And I think a lot of people would suggest this is indeed the worst of times. And fourth, as I have counseled in the past, broad exposure to many different kinds of asset classes is really the hallmark of successful investing over long periods of time. Now, a second very important investment lesson. Rebalancing your portfolio at least once a year is so key. If one asset class performs exceptionally well, sell enough of that asset to buy back those assets that aren't doing so well, to put your portfolio back into balance. Similarly, if international equities fall greater in value than U.S. equities, then you buy additional shares in those particular positions. For example, if you currently hold an emerging market stock position, as I do in our couch potato portfolio, well, big surprise, it's actually no surprise at all, those positions have been tremendously hammered. In fact, the emerging markets index is really almost 63%, can you believe it? Lower than it was on December 31 of 2007. Now, that's a position that when we rebalance our portfolio at the end of the year, I'm going to be buying more of that position because it has fallen greater than other positions in the portfolio, and as a result, I need to rebalance in that particular asset. So go back at the end of the year, probably just about the end of the year, pretty close to the last week, and look at, does my portfolio need rebalancing? How much has it changed from my essential percentages that I have in my asset allocation model? Further, with respect to 401k investors, continue to invest. Continue to invest monthly. Do not pull back. Do not take new money and say, I'm going to pull back from my 401k and just sit it on the sidelines. Remember, you are in the share accumulation business, not the price accumulation business. And your 401k monthly dollars are now buying more shares than at any time in recent memory. In fact, we've got to go back to approximately 2001 before the surge of the last stock market bull run to see prices at these kinds of levels. So when prices are relatively cheap, even though they may go down further, you are dollar cost averaging. You are buying more shares of stock than you were previously. That's a good thing for people who are contributing on a regular basis to their 401k. Why do you want to accumulate more shares? Because more shares means more dividends ultimately on those stock market positions. Remember, it's a share accumulation business, not a price accumulation business. Also, if you are currently required to take a minimum distribution from your IRA, and this is a difficult situation because a minimum distribution, as we all know, is based on the previous end-year balance. So let's say that, for example, December 31 of 07, you had $100,000 in your IRA. And today, you have $60,000 or less in your IRA, yet your minimum distribution that you are required to take is based on the $100,000, not the $60,000. That's really adding injury to insult. Well, what can you do? First, consider taking your distribution in stock or stock mutual funds by simply having your IRA plan sponsor distribute the shares in kind to an after-tax account. In other words, if you have an IRA account with a plan sponsor, open up an after-tax account with that plan sponsor and say, look, that $8,000 minimum distribution, transfer $8,000 of shares of stock into this account. Now, you will still be required to pay tax on that distribution, but you essentially won't be liquidating your stocks. They'll be now sitting in an after-tax account. Further, I'm often asked, should I take my IRA minimum distribution from the stock portion of my portfolio or the bond or money market portion of my portfolio, or should I do both? And that answer really depends. If you essentially don't need the money, then by all means, take the distribution from the cash or bond side of the portfolio. If you are relying, however, on your minimum distribution to live on, hedge your bet and take half from the income side and half from the stock side. Interestingly enough, there have been lots and lots of academic studies that have addressed this question, and there have been really very different results depending upon the period of time that you are looking at. And most of these academic studies, and myself included, really have reached the conclusion that you are really better off taking half from the income side, half from the stock side, essentially hedging your bets. That word hedge is sort of pejorative, David. I use it very, very carefully. Finally, consider today converting your traditional IRA to a tax-free Roth IRA. Now, the value is based on the actual conversion date. So again, if we had $100,000 in a traditional IRA program, you've seen that value diminish, for example, to $60,000, $50,000. You might consider saying, you know, this is essentially a good time to convert that traditional to a Roth IRA. Now, remember, when you do convert, whatever the value is at the date of conversion, that is going to subject you to ordinary income tax. So if your traditional IRA was now worth $50,000 and you converted to a Roth, you would have to report $50,000 of income. You might consider apportioning it. In other words, converting a portion of your traditional IRA to a Roth so you don't bump up to a higher income tax bracket. Now, in order to think about this, do this intelligently, obviously you need to consult with your own financial advisor and essentially your tax accountant, if you have one, to make certain, one, you are eligible to convert. And those rules aren't really that difficult. Essentially, what it really means is that if you have adjusted gross income of about $100,000 or less, exclusive of your conversion amount, then you would likely be able to convert from a traditional to a Roth IRA. But again, you need to talk with your advisor, your tax accountant, to see whether this is a sensible move. And indeed, it may well be for a number of folks sitting on traditional IRAs. All right, let's turn to our couch potato portfolio. I promise to report on it each month, whether it's good, bad, or ugly. We do report on it. You will recall that the portfolio basically consists of 8 indexes. We have the S&P 500, large value, small cap, small value. We have real estate in the REIT index. We even have total international indexes as well as emerging markets. And again, David, I believe that it has now been updated on the website. And is there any special way to go to that, for example?
We are doing some revamping on the website. So I am told that if you will go to will.uiuc.edu, which was the old version, right now we've been encouraging people to do Illinois. But if you do will.uiuc.edu, it should be there. I'll check myself on my computer here to make sure.
Okay, well, good. Well, here's the bottom line. First of all, we look at our benchmark, which is the S&P 500. And through yesterday's close, especially after all of the hemorrhaging this week, the S&P 500 index through the year, since December 31, is down almost 48% for the year, 47.7 to be more precise. How is our couch potato portfolio done so far? Well, we are down 52%. In our couch potato portfolio, essentially almost 4% more than the S&P 500. This is a year where essentially diversification has not helped because international markets are actually down further. They are down more than even U.S. markets. For example, the total international index is down some 56% for the year, and emerging markets, China, India, Brazil, Argentina, when we add them all together, they have suffered more than 63% losses year to date through yesterday's close. These are enormous, enormous numbers. If we look back at December 31 of 07 and we look at all of the value in the world on stock markets, that approximated near its high of about $70 trillion, about $68 trillion to be exact, but let's round it to $70 trillion. We subtract almost 50% from that worldwide, and we have a $35 trillion meltdown in global and world stock markets. Add to that, of course, the real estate values, which have diminished not only in the United States, but now have diminished throughout Europe. It's no wonder that people aren't buying. It's no wonder that people aren't consuming. It makes perfect sense that people are holding back with all kinds of purchases. And it's going to be up to global leaders. It's going to be up to some very sharp economists to restore consumer confidence, to restore some of the financial integrity that we have lost so we can begin a recovery. But nevertheless, there will be a recovery. It's not a matter of if there's going to be a recovery. Obviously, it's a matter of when. So there you have it, David, a little bit of history, a little bit of hope in spite of some terribly bad news. I'd be happy to address these issues, of course, or any of the other questions that our listeners want to speak about.
All right. And we have several callers. Let me just mention one more time that that information that we gave you, if just for the moment, if you're interested in looking at the update of the Couch Potato portfolio, you'll have to go to the older version of our website, but it is there. So go to WILL.UIUC.EDU. Go to AM Focus 580 links and you will find it. And of course, here on the program, we're happy to take questions from people who are listening. We have some folks ready to go. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And our guest is David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. First caller is in Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I had a question about retirement funds versus mortgage. My husband and I are both 25, and we currently contribute to our work retirement plans as well as maxing out our Roth IRAs. But we're looking to purchase a home soon, and so we're wondering if during those first couple years of our mortgage, if it's all right to pull back slightly on our Roth contributions, or if maxing out our retirement savings is something that should really always be a first priority.
Well, you know, that's a great question, and a number of people ask that question, and it really has a different answer depending upon your individual circumstances. First of all, I applaud you for being able to put money both into your corporate-sponsored plans as well as your own Roth IRAs. Let me ask you this. How old are your Roth IRAs?
We both have them about 5 years.
All right. And are you first-time home buyers?
Yes.
Now, interestingly enough, you probably already know the Roth IRA rule, which says that if you are a first-time home buyer and your Roth IRA has spanned at least 5 different years, you are entitled on a tax-free basis, for example, to take up to $10,000 out of your Roth IRA and use it toward a down payment on your home.
Okay. Do you see that as a good idea to do?
Well, it depends on what interest rate that you can negotiate on your purchase.
Okay.
But I think that over the long run, to be very frank about it, unless you are going to itemize on your tax return, you are probably best off to have a little bit lower mortgage payment each month. Now, a lot of people would disagree with that and say, look, when inflation rears its ugly head eventually, when you are making those mortgage payments, you are paying them back in cheaper dollars. So I want you to make certain, number one, that you are funding your corporate retirement plans and getting whatever matches are necessary. Number two, I think it's very laudable that you continue to fund your Roth IRAs, but think about that as a possibility. You really need to sit down with a financial advisor and look at, does that make sense? Your other question, of course, is, are you planning to stretch, or are you planning to essentially buy something well within your means?
Buy something pretty well within our means.
Okay. I think that is very, very wise advice today. And of course, if you are in the home buying market, I think your timing is impeccable. I really do. I think you're going to have lots of inventory to choose from, and you are really in the negotiation seat. One other thing that you might do before you actually start making offers, thinking about purchasing, you might contact a local lender and pre-qualify to see what kinds of mortgages, one, are available at what rates for you based upon your own credit scores, and two, what kind of principal that you could actually borrow. I think that's important to know ahead of time before you actually start looking at properties. Something else that I would recommend before you actually start looking at the properties and driving around and see them, sit down with your realtor, explain to your realtor exactly what you're looking for. Is it three bedrooms, two bathrooms, and a two-car attached garage in a certain neighborhood? If it is, if you have those parameters, sit down with your realtor at the realtor's computer. That's step number one always. And have your realtor essentially print off for you all of the current listings that meet your requirements. And that way you can examine them and see how long they've been on the market, whether there have been price reductions, et cetera. It gives you a whole host of information. Then you can do your own homework. Maybe there's 10 or 15 of those. Drive by them. See if they have curb appeal. See if you could see yourself living in this particular area. And then go back to your realtor and say, okay, we've seen these 10 or 15. There are four or five that might meet our parameters. Let's get more information on these four or five. So now let's pull out the particulars on those four or five. One particular that you might want to know, for example, is in this neighborhood, what are prices actually selling at as compared to listing price? Mm-hmm. How long have houses been on the market? Okay? Show me comparables to this particular house. Show me comparables that have actually sold. So you can do lots and lots and lots of good financial homework before you actually step one step inside that property. It's sort of like looking for an automobile. You want to go to the internet, understand safety, understand all the issues, understand pricing before you smell that new leather seat, all right? Because you do want to take the emotion out of purchasing, especially when you are a first-time home purchaser, where emotion can run away with you. All right?
All right. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Let's go on to another caller. This is someone in Bethany. This is line number four. Hello.
Good morning to both Davids.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I realize there's been a lot of causes to this financial fiasco we're in, but I'd like to have your opinion, Mr. Steno, about the what do you think the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act contributed to this mess?
Oh, in terms of allowing all of these financial institutions essentially to do almost anything?
Yes.
Yeah, well, there's no question that we were asleep on the regulatory side of things. And basically, while I am a great believer in generally less regulation is best, especially on small businesses, we can see that where the federal government has such a dramatic impact, or agencies of the federal government have such a dramatic impact on our financial well-being and financial institutions, that certain types of regulation are clearly necessary. And obviously, we're going to see more regulation in the next administration in these various sectors, on the financial sector, on the mortgage sector. I was reading this morning that, interestingly enough, we all know the story on Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, but most mortgages that are being written today and underwritten are being written by the Federal Home Loan Authority under FHA, and it's now coming to fruition that a lot of these loans may well have the same problems that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have, again, because they are not properly regulated. So I think we're going to see more regulation. That certainly had a great deal to do with the fiasco, as well as this tremendous ideological and philosophical impetus to put as many people into home ownership as possible over the last 10 years. That was a publicly shared goal, whether you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, or liberal. That was a publicly shared goal, and we just put an awful lot of folks into homes that had no business being in those homes and procuring mortgages.
Well, I agree. I read the papers and listened to the news all through last year with these no-income loans, essentially liar loans, and I kept waiting. Isn't somebody going to put a stop to this?
You would think so. You know, in the old days, you and I remember this, that when I originally would procure a mortgage on a piece of property, there used to be something called Fannie Mae guidelines. They were called the 28 and 36% rule. Mm-hmm. And that 28% rule said, look, you add up the total cost of your mortgage payments, the total cost of your real estate taxes, the total cost of your insurance, and if you're in a condominium, that monthly condominium fee. And that total cost should not exceed 28% of your gross income. And furthermore, you add to that any loans that you've got, maybe they were student loans, maybe they were automobile loans, maybe they were loans down at the bank, and you add all of that stuff together, and by no means should that ever be more than 36% of your gross income. Those were the old guidelines, and when we stuck to those, we were pretty darn safe. Then a funny thing happened. Everybody had a credit reporting score. And a whole bunch of mathematical work was done that said, look, based on your credit score, how likely are you to default? So we went away from the 28 and 36% guidelines, and we started using credit scores. Well, it was wonderful if you had a 750 to 800 credit score, but a whole lot of folks had 700, 600, 620, even into the 500s, and the underwriting standards were decreased. They were lessened. So as a result, people with really no credit, bad credit, were allowed to essentially interface into the mortgage market. And between that and some unscrupulous lenders, well, you see the results.
Well, yeah, but even if you have a very good credit history, if you borrow way more than you can afford to pay, it doesn't really make any difference. You still can't pay the loan.
Well, you're right, and it's kind of like the federal government, isn't it?
Yeah.
Spending more than we can afford. Yeah, your points are well taken. You're preaching to the choir.
Okay. Well, I just wanted your opinion about Glass-Steagall because I wasn't happy when they repealed that in the first place.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Just now, I have other callers. I just want to ask real quick, though, for people who have FHA loans, is it not still required that you have insurance? I thought part of the deal was you actually had to pay.
Well, that's right.
Insurance.
You do buy
it.
So those loans,
are covered.
Those loans are covered, and those loans have now been sold into the secondary market. But typically, those loans only require 2 to 3% down payment. So again, we've got a situation where people, as a result of this dramatic drop in housing prices, are upside down in these loans. Mm-hmm. And if you're $100,000 upside down in your loan, in other words, your loan is $100,000 more than the value of your house, guess what?
Yeah.
People are walking away.
Right. Let's go on here. Our guest, by the way, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at U of I in Urbana-Champaign. Once a month, always on a Friday, he's here. We do these shows on personal finance, and questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign and line 3. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about money markets. We have our emergency fund stored in Vanguard Prime Money Market Fund, which I've always heard was the best place to keep it. You know, it earns some interest, but it's still liquid and so on. And then I read a few weeks ago that there was some concern about money market funds, that the shares were going to drop below $1 per share. And Vanguard has continually reassured people, no, that's not the case. But I just would like your opinion on it, whether we should take maybe part of that money and put it in CDs or something that has a guarantee, since we know that the money market fund is not federally guaranteed. What do you think?
Well, as it turns out, Vanguard, along with many other mutual fund companies, have joined and are paying an insurance fee to the federal government so that the federal government actually is insuring those money market accounts. So as it turns out, many, many money market accounts, as a result of about 2 months ago when some of the money market accounts broke the buck, they went below a dollar because they were holding a lot of toxic paper, very short-term toxic paper, in their money market funds, that as a result, the government came in with about a $40 billion guarantee. Now, as far as Vanguard is concerned, I will tell you, number one, I have money in Vanguard Prime, although the majority of my short-term money is in Vanguard U.S. Treasury Trust. I have no problem with Vanguard Prime, especially since it is backed now by the U.S. government guarantee and is insured. So that puts it in a completely different situation. Nevertheless, Vanguard has always been very conservative. And if you look at the actual holdings in Vanguard Prime, well over 50 to 60% of them are denominated simply in U.S. securities to begin with. So I feel very, very comfortable in Vanguard Prime. They're very carefully managed, and I don't think you should have any difficulty sleeping. Now, as it turns out, if you took money out of Vanguard Prime and shopped, you probably could get a higher interest rate in a certificate of deposit. In fact, some 12-month CDs are now currently paying in the area of about 4%. Money actually is being bid up, whereas Vanguard Prime, I believe, is around 2% today on an annualized basis. It was obviously higher, but interest rates are trending down. Right. So in Vanguard Prime, you've got instant liquidity. You pull out your checkbook. You want to write a check. You have it automatically. You tie your money up in a CD. All right. You're going to obviously earn a higher interest rate, but there's a little less access to that money. Now, of course, the FDIC, who's the FDIC? That's you and I. Essentially, we now have individual accounts insured up to $250,000 at banks.
Right.
So you could have $250,000 at a bank in a CD, and it is FDIC-backed, which really is you and I.
Yeah.
But in answer to your essential question, I have no issues with Vanguard Prime.
So it's safe. We could maybe get more interest elsewhere, but it's
but you're sacrificing liquidity.
Right, exactly. All right, thanks very much for your information.
Right, my pleasure.
Thank you. Our next caller is in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a few questions that are based on what I'm reading and hearing about, and it seems that some of the things that are being done to respond to the tight amount of money to be loaned by banks seems counterintuitive. And I wanted to know, why do you think banks are not raising interest rates on CDs, money markets, and savings accounts to actually promote savings, giving them more money to then loan out and thereby making what now appears to be tight money less tight? And secondly, it seems that with the decline of about 50% in the cost of gasoline and petroleum, that there should be also a commensurate decline in all the increases that we've seen that were justified by the increase in gas and petroleum, and yet we're not seeing that. And along the same line, the justification for higher real estate taxes no longer exists, and we don't see that coming down. In fact, locally, they're continuing to go up. So although what is going on seems counterintuitive to those kinds of things. I like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, those are all wonderful questions. Let's start with real estate taxes. And this is an enormous issue for all municipalities, governmental institutions that rely on real estate taxes. The truth of the matter is that generally real estate taxes are going to stay flat. They're not going to go down unless you appeal your real estate taxes. That is the bottom line. And have you ever seen a real estate tax bill go down unless in the rare instance where some bonding indebtedness was paid off, perhaps by a school system, et cetera, where your actual rate went down. But your assessed valuation of your property rarely, rarely goes down, even in something called a quadrennial reassessment, where every 4 years, at least in the state of Illinois, values are supposed to at least be reassessed and brought up or brought down to current market values. But because of the enormity of the difficulty, it's very unusual for assessed valuations to drop unless you take the affirmative step of actually filing an appeal. It might be as simple as just walking into the county assessor and filling out a form, handing them an appraisal. And very often, especially in this market, you may see a reduction in your real estate assessment. Whether or not that translates into a reduction in taxes simply depends upon the tax rate that is in effect during that period of time. So bottom line with real estate taxes, you've got to have the affirmative responsibility. You've got to take it on yourself to make those changes. Now, Your first question had to do with, well, why aren't banks raising rates, essentially buying money, and then being able to loan it out? Well, there's a couple of things going on. First, there are some banks that are actually buying deposits. When you see CD rates out there in the 4% range, those are folks that are buying deposits, especially when treasury rates, short-term treasury rates, are less than 1%. Can you imagine? So that tells me that those particular banks, one, have loan demand, and two, they feel reasonably comfortable loaning that money out. The truth of the matter is today that banks, even if they have money to loan, are very fearful of loaning money out because they are so concerned about getting repaid. So as a result, they're not in the business today of loaning money because they're seeing business failures on a daily basis, bankruptcies on a daily basis, consumers pulling in on a daily basis. So they're very concerned about even loaning money out, let alone renewing lines of credit, different kinds of credit facilities for different institutions and or businesses. So as a result, they're not out there buying money. If they were buying money at 4%, the question becomes, what are they going to do with it? Where are they going to invest it carefully? Well, in the old days, you could probably put it in securitized mortgages. Well, you certainly can't do that today. In the old days, you could comfortably loan it out, and perhaps 1% or 2% of the folks that you loan money to would default. That bet is off today. So as a result, banks are really not out there essentially trying to attract a lot of deposits unless they have bona fide loan demand that they feel comfortable with. Now, your third question had to do with, oh my goodness, well, gas prices used to be $4 a gallon. Now they're $2 a gallon. Oil, a barrel of oil, it used to be $140, $150. Now it's $50. It went down to $50, although it's gone up a little bit today. So keep in mind that when America has a 50% reduction in the cost of gasoline, that's bigger than the last stimulus package. That is actually bigger than the rebate checks that people got who were taxpayers. All right? So that's probably a little bit of good news for the consumer. But your question is a different question. Well, gee, if these raw materials have dropped so precipitously, why hasn't that followed on the retail side? Well, the truth of the matter is that the retail side was not making very much money in the first place. In fact, they were often losing money because they were paying these dramatically higher prices for the raw materials. So as a result, now that they for the first time are actually paying less for the raw materials, they are loath. They are very, very slow to reduce prices. They are trying to protect or make up for lost profits otherwise. So bottom line, they're putting this back on the backs of the American consumer. And I think that's the major reason that we're not seeing concomitant decreases, for example, in all of these other areas. Hope that answers all three questions.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David Sinnoh. He's here once a month on a Friday to talk about personal finance. He's clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business here in Urbana-Champaign. And we have a number of other calls. We'll see if we can get everybody in. And next up, we'll go to Peoria, line 2. Hello. Is there a caller there in Peoria, line 2? Yes, go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I had a question. Mainly have in the past been invested in CDs, and I have farmland. I'm at retirement age, and I'm looking at the stock market at this point a little bit because the CD rates on the last renewals have been very, very low. So I'm wondering about moving some small percentage of the CD money into the stock market, something like utility stock. Any ideas for me?
Well, I'm really not an investor in individual stocks. I think you're looking in the right direction. You're thinking about dividends. Interestingly enough, on the S&P 500 today.
Yes.
Now, whether or not these companies will continue to pay dividends, but when you spend a dollar in the S&P 500, your dividend yield is now approaching 3%. Isn't that interesting? That's because the price of these stocks have dramatically decreased. Let me give you a strategy. I'll leave the individual stock picking up to you. But let me give you a strategy. Let's say that you are thinking of taking 5% of your overall net worth in putting it into the stock market. What I would suggest is that with that 5%, you break it down into perhaps 18 different increments so that you would average into a position over the next 18 months. So let's say that that was $50,000, just pretend. I would divide that by 18, and that would be the amount of money that I would place into the stock market over the next 18 months. So I would average in, just as people can average out of a market, I would average in. And frankly, if it were me, I'm not smart enough to figure out what individual stocks to buy. There have to be some great values, whether it's GE, Procter & Gamble, some of these great companies. They're not going to go away. I don't think so. Perhaps in the farm area, you probably want to diversify out of that. So maybe a company like John Deere, even though it's a great company, is probably not one to buy currently for you. I would be more prone to buy a very, very large index, something like a total market index, a Wilshire 5000 index, where I have broad, broad, broad exposure to literally thousands of companies on a market-weighted basis, something like the even the Vanguard Total Market Index. And I would then be averaging into that every month, and if the market continued to go down, I would continue to average in because I know I'm buying more and more shares at cheaper prices, and I'm in it for the long period of time. It's kind of like all the farm people I know. They're sort of in it for a long, long period of time.
Yes, and then would that be paying dividends, or are those rolled back into the...
Well, you have a choice. You have a choice. When you set up that type of account, you can either mark the box that says, send me my dividends, or alternatively, roll those dividends back into purchasing more shares of stock. You have the choice.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Okay, good. Thank you.
All right, thank you. On to a caller in Monticello. And line number three. Hello.
Good morning, David. We're a retired couple living partially on interest and dividends, and thanks to your advice some time back, we have money now in Vanguard Treasury Money Market Fund.
Wonderful.
And I'm thinking, yeah, thank you. And I'm thinking now of moving some. Three quick questions. What bond funds would you buy now? What bond funds would you not buy now? And when would you consider buying into TIPS? Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. I'd like to hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, hang on.
Okay.
Number one, I'm not a bond fund buyer, period, at the moment. I don't think this is an appropriate time to buy bonds. I think that if you want to buy individual issues, it's all right, but I'm very, very leery of buying bond funds. Now, having said that, I think that if you wanted to shop some of your money market money and put it into short-term certificates of deposit with essentially maturities of 7 to 12 months, I think you will find in our area some very, very handsome rates of return, approximately in the 4% area, which is almost double what you are earning in Vanguard Prime. Now, I continue to see that until this erosion of prices in real estate and the stock market turn around, I would be leery of putting money into a bond fund. So I just can't counsel you to do that. If you were thinking of doing it, the only bond fund I would consider are TIPS. And again, I would average into that position over 12 to 15 months.
And you can't suggest any short-term Vanguard fund right now, bond fund?
I really can't. I think you're better off in a short-term CD. I think you just have too much interest rate risk in any of the bond funds, and Vanguard has great bond funds. They have a short-term corporate fund, which is very, very good. You have to, if you're going to be in any kind of bond fund today, you want to look at two factors. You want to look at maturity of the bond fund. When is the average maturity of those bonds, and when is the average duration of those bonds? In other words, how fast you get paid back on your money, including interest. And I'm just very, very leery of anything that has a maturity and a duration of greater than perhaps 24 months. So those are the keys that you would want to look at.
Thank you for that advice, and I'm going to assume that it's as good as the last bit of advice of yours I followed.
Okay, well, good. Thanks so much.
Thank you. We'll go on to Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, all.
How are you?
I'm just fine.
Good.
The streams are freezing up.
Yeah, I know that. It's too cold to even go fishing out there.
You're right there.
Yeah, yeah.
You said very early in the show that the stock market is indicative of the future to some extent. And taking that information and putting it with the aspect of what unemployment is doing today, it looks like we're really going to, a lot of people are going to get more and more unemployed.
I agree.
Which is a scary thing, because that's going to stop consumption even more.
I agree.
So I'm wondering, how are we going to get around this? Because way back a year or so ago, you and I discussed this, when we first started seeing Spain taking care of the banks there, and now we're all the way here a year later, there's no money left to take care of the individual, who is really the source of all the economy.
Right. So what is going to happen? You and I already know this, and this is not rocket history, and this is what a lot of people are thinking. We're going to try to inflate our way out of this. We're going
exactly.
to print more money.
Exactly.
All right. Now, whether we're going to hand it directly to the banks or whether they're going to hand it to people in terms of unemployment compensation or health benefits or however we're going to hand it to folks, or maybe we're going to renegotiate mortgages and loans, here's the bottom line. The bottom line is that somewhere in the future, we are going to have tremendous amounts of inflation. That's my prediction. I really believe that, because that's how we're going to essentially move beyond this current crisis, which is looking more and more like a deflationary spiral as opposed to an inflationary spiral. So we're going to print more money, and that means that hard assets are actually going to ultimately go back up in value, and things are going to get more expensive.
And that's where I was going to get for people to think about. Now, if you have extra cash that people are putting in different things, sometimes it's very good to self-finance yourself and buy assets that are now cheap that are going to inflate in value.
No question. No question.
So maybe buying actual solid pieces of property is a good idea.
Well, I think ultimately it is, and I think ultimately it makes a great deal of sense if you want to be in the real estate business. That I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying. It's just that most people can't see themselves doing it. And the bottom line is, if you do go out and purchase real estate, you don't want to have a lot of leverage in that particular position.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Right. My pleasure.
Thank you. Go to line number one for the next caller. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I followed your advice, David, and put money in my money market in the Treasury account.
Yes.
But I gathered from what you said just a minute ago that you might take some of that out and put it into CDs, local CDs. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. I don't have a problem with that. Very, very recently, actually in about the last 2 weeks to 3 weeks, CD rates have ticked up, and they've ticked up precipitously, where there are a number of local institutions, if you shop, I'm seeing 4% on those CD rates.
For and how long?
Well, I'm seeing them anywhere from 7 to 11 months.
Uh-huh.
All right? And I think over the next 7 months to 11 months, that's as good a bet as any, especially
right.
with the FDIC insurance. And keep in mind that it's very interesting that under this $250,000 rule, if someone was lucky enough to be in this position, that you could have $250,000 in a wife, $250,000 in a husband with different Social Security numbers. Both of those accounts are FDIC insured. Interestingly
right.
enough, you could have $250,000 payable on death to a child or two children, and you could have additional CDs that
right.
are insured. So it's
right.
very, very possible in one financial institution, although I'm not sure that I would recommend it, to have far more than even $250,000 in FDIC insurance.
Right.
Unfortunately, we just don't know a whole lot of folks that have that kind of money laying around. But in
right.
any event, for people who are sitting in money markets, that is certainly a realistic alternative.
Right.
Just over the last couple of weeks.
I had been in the Vanguard tax-exempt money market, but that's still a little scary. Isn't
it? It's a little bit scary, but nevertheless, it is a money market, so it has the same insurance that Prime or Treasury Trust would have. But again,
oh.
it's a little bit more scary.
Oh, I see, but it has that insurance.
Yes.
Okay.
I think it is listed on the Vanguard website. I believe it does. You can double-check on the Vanguard website, and it will show the money market funds that are covered under the government program.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Right. One more champagne. Line two. Hello.
Yes, David, I'm sorry that I turned in a little late, and I didn't quite follow your explanation of the required minimum distribution. And in order to save time, what I'd like to say is I have the money to pay the IRS what I owe them, but I'd rather not pay them by taking severely deflated
stock.
Stock, yes.
Right.
Out of my IRA
Here's what you do.
Account.
Here's what you do.
Okay.
You go back to your IRA plan sponsor and set up a taxable account. All right? Just a second account.
Okay.
And then you request that the distribution from your IRA be in stock and that stock be transferred. So if your minimum distribution is $10,000, take $10,000 of stock, don't liquidate the stock, $10,000 of stock, and have them transfer that to your taxable account. It's still a distribution. Now you hold the stock in a taxable account. Your basis in that stock is $10,000, and you're going to get a 1099 at the end of the year saying you took a $10,000 distribution, but you now have the stock with a basis of $10,000 in a taxable account.
Okay. So that as long as I'm willing to gamble, that value will go up.
Absolutely.
I am not losing anything by being caught short on the time.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. How do I pay? Do I pay then my mutual fund company, or do I send a check to the IRS, or how does that work?
No, you're going to get it's no different than if the mutual fund company sent you a check for $10,000. They essentially put $10,000 in another account. At the end of the year, you're going to get your IRS 1099 distribution form.
Oh, and that will cover me with the IRS.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
My pleasure. Right,
very good. Well, we are just about at the end here. Any last sort of thought you'd like to leave with folks?
Well, I'm very happy, David, that a fellow like you who's been very, very careful all of his life and has really essentially put away, you know, scores of millions of dollars, that I know that you've been careful and that in your portfolio you're just sitting on these scores of millions in treasuries. So I'm just thankful that someone over the last 18 and a half years has benefited from my advice.
See, if I actually followed the advice that all of the people on this program had given over the years, I think I would have retired by now. But no, here I am. Here I'll be. I'll be 80 years old. I'll still be hosting the show if they'll have me, probably.
Okay. The only other comment I'd like to make, David, is that, one, I love your humor, and two, I want to wish everyone, in spite of the markets, a very, very joyous and, most importantly, healthy Thanksgiving holiday.
Thank you very much. David Sino, he is clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign once a month, always on a Friday. He's here, and we take your questions on personal finance, and he'll be back next month. We'll do it again. The program is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers four area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. In newspapers and in magazines, on the radio, on television, on the internet, we got all kinds of messages telling us to eat this and not that, to take these supplements, to avoid doing this or that. How do you sort the good information from the bad? That is the question that Celeste Quinn will be taking up with her guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. The guest is Robert Davis. He is a health journalist with a PhD in health policy from Brandeis, and he is the author of the book The Healthy Skeptic, and she will be the guest in the 1 o'clock hour. The show itself gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news and weather and sports. You can talk to Ed Kieser, our meteorologist, get a weather forecast if you'll be traveling. All of that on the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn, and the show starts at noon. In the next hour of this program, we'll be talking with Tim Palmer. He is an award-winning conservation and nature writer and photographer. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. We'll talk in part about one of his recent books full of really beautiful photographs that's titled Rivers of America. First, though, we'll break for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right to the pits in Kansas City and Chicago and get the current prices in Kansas City. December wheat now trading at 541. It's down 7.25. March at 556 is down 6.5. At the Chicago Board of Trade, December wheat is 502 and three quarters, down 9. March, 521 and three quarters, down 9 1/4. May, 535 and a quarter, down 9 1/2. July, 549, down 9 1/4. December corn, 349 and three quarters, down 14. March, 365 and a half, down 14 and a half. May, 376 and a half, down 14 and a half. July, 387 and three quarters, down 14. September, $4, down 12. December, 412 and a quarter, down 13 and three quarters. January beans, 850 and a half, down 5 1/2. March, 857 and three quarters, down 5. May, 867, down 4 1/2. July, 876 and three quarters, down 2 1/4. September, 870, down 9.